This is Monk talking about finding your voices, letting the muses sing in you. That's how Homer's Odyssey begins. Sing in me, O muse. St. Francis says, make me an instrument of thy peace. So there's this looking to something other than one's self to help out with the writing. Now, that may become a combination in there. It's sometimes hard to say because it is you writing. Otherwise, you get into the whole channeling, or what do they call spontaneous writing, which can happen. But the gist of it is it's kind of like a relationship. It's part you, part other, part stuff, other stuff, whether it's whoever you might be invoking. That's helped me with my writing. It helps me. Various prayers or rituals to speak to other than physical beings, angelic beings, different presences that then sometimes give an idea or a way of looking at it that the little I self didn't have. So a lot of times it's being able to look at it from another perspective. Sometimes if something is not working or flowing, sleeping on it, meditating on it, sometimes that shifts the awareness. Here's an example from a book by David Abram. I don't have it right in front of me. The Spell of the Sensuous, I think it's called. It's talking about a native people's, I think it says in the quote, maybe not. Oh yeah, the Koyukon people. Not sure where they are. Caribou, for instance, are said to sing through human beings when in their vicinity, granting the tribe's people songs that certain persons remember upon awaking from sleep. When those persons sing these songs later, their success in finding and hunting caribou is ensured. Tribal elders, meanwhile, listen closely to the rippling cries and wails of the loon as a source of inspiration in composing their own songs and chants. Animals and plants once shared a common language with human beings. There's another example of, I think it's the Mi'kmaq, listening to the sound in that the wind makes in the trees at around sundown, maybe a certain time of year, that they're able to detect problems with the trees, or they name the trees that way and maybe detect various problems or whatever's going on. So I think also listening is a key thing. It's listening for voices, that are different than sort of what your voice is. I mean, some of the idea is as a writer is to kind of find your voice, but I think that can be open to people having multiple voices, or that there is maybe an under-truthing, I like to say, because why lie? Not underlying, under-truthing sense of one's voice that comes through when you read someone. You kind of say, oh, that's his or her work, but I think that allows for other voices. For me, essays, a lot of times I like to use quotes, so that's it's kind of a group. The writing is, I don't just think of it as I am my writing. It's part of my goal is to present writing and information, feelings, ideas, present that to people in the best way I can. So if another's quote or another's word assists that, then I typically go for that. Sometimes stuff with too much quotes, you're wondering, hey, who is anybody writing? So it works both ways. You kind of have to feel your way with that. So I think part of the English that we grow up with is false in the sense of personification. We say, oh, we're just fancifully making the desk personification, when in actuality the desk is made like lovely oak desk. Here is from an oak tree, so there's actually a living being still at some level living in the desk. So it's not just a personifying, it's not just a fanciful thing, it's actually maybe tuning in to voices and literally other ways of seeing or someone else's perspective. A lot of writers who do kind of socialist or activist work as part of their writing goal is that cliche, but I like it. Just cliche because it's used a lot, but I like it, you know, be the voice for the voiceless. So that's another angle on one's multi-voices. Obviously, someone, say, writing a play. I think it was Edward Albee that I heard or read an interview that, you know, he would work upstairs in his office all day and writing a play and having all the characters come to life. And by the time it was time to have dinner, it was tricky because he had all this like people's voices talking in his head. But so it was challenging to actually be around people sometimes. Another part, one of my great inspirations is Ray Bradbury, who encouraged the flow of writing and enjoying it. And so in that flow happens things that, again, is not trying to think too much about how to write it. He's got an excellent book called Zen in the Art of Writing, Releasing the Creative Genius Within You. And he writes here, Dandelion Wine, that's one of my favorite books. It's memories of a childhood, a boy's childhood growing up in, I think it was in Illinois. Dandelion Wine, like most of my books and stories, was a surprise. I began to learn the nature of such surprises, thank God, when I was fairly young as a writer. Before that, like every beginner, I thought you could beat, pummel, and thrash an idea into existence. It was with great relief then that in my early 20s I floundered into a word association process in which I simply got out of bed each morning, walked to my desk, and put down any word or series of words that happened along in my head. I would then take arms against the word or for it and bring on an assortment of characters to weigh the word and show me its meaning in my own life. An hour or 2 hours later, to my amazement, a new story would be finished and done. The surprise was total and lovely. I soon found that I would have to work this way for the rest of my life. First, I rummaged my mind for words that could describe my personal nightmares, fears of night, and times from childhood and shape stories from these. Then I took a look at the green apple trees and the old house I was born in and the house next door where lived my grandparents and all the lawns of all the summers for the summers I grew up in, and I began to try words for all that. What you have in Dandelion Wine, then, is a gathering of dandelions from all those years. The wine metaphor, which appears again and again in these pages, is wonderfully apt. I was gathering images all my life, storing them away and forgetting them. Somehow I had to send myself back with words as catalysts to open the memories out and see what they had to offer. So that's a beautiful example of reminder of the, not only can you hear the sound and the enthusiasm as that writing flows, but the like the phrase, the storehouse, that I think even in any given day at night, if you were just to start describing stuff or write stuff, there would be stuff would come out that's whatever you call collective unconscious or your subconscious or in your psyche, however you call it, that stuff, those observations and the sensory awarenesses are there. And so the actual writing process is also a way to tap into your voices and calling it the muses for the most common Greek reference. It could be part of yourself, a spirit being, a writing guide, whatever you want to call it, an angelic presence, whatever you want to call it, doesn't matter, except if it matters. but it's kind of giving the space to allow those beings to come in. And so sometimes it's just writing, sort of like the way you have a nice conversation with somebody, and in that conversation you come up with ideas or bounce ideas back and forth. Being a writer is kind of that experience where you're bouncing around ideas in your own head, and the actual writing process can be like a conversation where you write something and you look at it or read it and say, what does that mean? Or what more could I say? Or, oh, there's a visual image. Now I need an auditory image. So you kind of, by dialoguing with yourself and with the writing, that can help the writing come alive as well. There's the river. I like the river as a metaphor. The as if you're going out to a river every day to look and see, and there's a flow happening. The river is flowing, and you check every day to see with your senses, with all your senses, your sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, your intuitive sense, your third eye, and psychic sense, whatever you call it, sixth sense. But you look, whether it's a river, or the sky, or the garden, or the traffic. It's checking in daily, making a ritual of noticing what's going on and feeling it and seeing if it prompts something. And some days it might be nothing, or some days just a brief image, or some days a kind of awareness that you store that comes out later, and sometimes a whole idea for a poem or a story or a book will just come pouring out. But the helpful thing is that you check. You check the to take a look and be with that river, be with that woods, be with your house plant, however you want to do it. But make a point to check in, because again, that's getting you outside your limited self. And another Bradbury inspiring quote: only the What is all this to do with writing the short story in our times? Only this: if you are writing without zest, without gusto, without love, without fun, you are only half a writer. It means you are so busy keeping the eye on the commercial market or one ear peeled for the avant-garde coterie that you are not being yourself. You don't even know yourself. For the first thing a writer should be is excited. He should be a thing of fevers and enthusiasms. Without such vigor, he might as well be out picking peaches or digging ditches. God knows it'd be better for him or her. So that reminds me about, I went through a phase where I had to, I didn't had to, but I started stuff that I was very much, I can be very much like a sponge. So if I read a certain poet, I would then go write a poem that imitated or was a flavor of their poetry, which is okay. That happens a lot of times. It feeds into the poetry, but it's after a while I'd be started to wonder, well, if I read something, I'm gonna sort of copy it. So I tuned out all other stuff. I even started looking at some classic, famous literature, and just thought that it wasn't any good. And I had to just kind of, I don't had to, but that's the feeling, was like I had to just tune all out that other stuff to find my voice. And it did, it helped. It helped me come up with, find different things that work, or things that just tend to be my voice. I don't even know how to define it right now. But that's part of it. That can be part of the process too, of looking at what inspires you or what affects your writing, and then deciding whether to feed that or to not feed that, sort of to, cut off certain things that are flavoring your writing, if it's not as original as you think you could be, or if you find yourself repeating yourself, which writers tend to do. Another book that I read some of, it's edited by Mason Curry. It's called Daily Rituals: How Artists Work. And it is not just artists, it's writers, composers, painters, choreographers, playwrights, poets, philosophers, filmmakers, sculptors, scientists. Mostly artists, but he gives all. It's actually mostly in their words, different descriptions. And from this, just reading some of this book, I realize there is no, no pun intended. There is no right way. There is no correct way to do anything. It's finding the what works for you. So some writers like having a view of the ocean if they, could have it. Other writers like a blank wall. Some work on a schedule, some don't. There's one woman in here who, some genre I'm not fond of, but I forget her name, but she described having to put herself in a kind of hedonistic state to be able to create. So she would sit in bed with like a bowl of sugar donuts and having a drink or smoking a cigarette or something, just totally feeding her own sort of hedonistic pleasure and sensory stimulus, and that would help her write. So there's all different kinds, and I'm gonna read a few just to give you a flavor of these. One of my favorites is, oh yeah, another thing I noticed too, though, it also depends on the writing. Poetry is more kind of here, free form. Someone writing a novel or a nonfiction piece, a lot of the novel writers have very disciplined schedule of getting up and working at a certain time. One took a bath, takes a took a took a bath before writing, maybe still does. Because sometimes they're thinking of words. How many? Oh yeah, that's a Somerset Maugham, one of the funniest. Oh no, that's I'm thinking of P.G. Wodehouse. Somerset Maugham would. I'll read his. So some are more disciplined and making a schedule for yourself, which may work. I find poetry tends to be much more spontaneous. But again, whatever works for you, finding your way. Maybe just free form journaling gives you bits or images, or at the beginning or the end of the day, writing down just notes of what you observed, and then the next day or what you felt, anything. Went to work, drove the car, blah blah blah. It sounds all boring, but then tangerine sunrise, and you're like, whoa, I got to put that in. So that you could write something every day and then just put it aside, look at it the next day, and pick out of it for some poems. Here's Somerset Maugham. Maugham thought that writing, like drinking, was an easy habit to form and a difficult one to break. It was more an addiction than a vocation. The addiction served him well. In his nearly 92 years, Maugham published 78 books. He wrote for 3 or 4 hours every morning, setting himself a daily requirement of 1,000 to 1,500 words. He would get a start on the day's work before he even sat down at the desk, thinking of the first two sentences he wanted to write while soaking in the bath. Then, once at work, there was little to distract him. Maugham believed that it was impossible to write while looking at a view, so his desk always faced a blank wall. When he wrapped up his morning's work at about noon, Maugham often felt impatient to begin again. When you're writing, when you're creating a character, it's with you constantly. You're preoccupied with it. It's alive, he said, adding that when you cut that out of your life, it's a rather lonely life. Yeah, I gotta find Maya Angelou, because that's one of my favorites in here to read. Here it is, one page, one, two, three. Yeah, this is okay, this is a little bit longer. Angelou has never been able to write at home. I try to keep home very pretty, she has said, and I can't work in a pretty surrounding. It throws me. As a result, she has always worked in hotel or motel rooms, if you can afford it. The more anonymous, the better. She described her routine in a 1983 interview. I usually get up at about 5:30, and I'm ready to have coffee by 6, usually with my husband. He goes off to his work around 6:30, and I go off to mine. I keep a hotel room in which I do my work, a tiny, mean room with just a bed, and sometimes, if I can find it, a face basin. I keep a dictionary, a Bible, a deck of cards, and a bottle of sherry in the room. I try to get there around 7, and I work until 2 in the afternoon. If the work is going badly, I stay until 12:30. If it's going well, I'll stay as long as it's going well. It's lonely and it's marvelous. I edit while I'm working. When I come home at 2, I read over what I've written that day and then try to put it out of my mind. I shower, prepare dinner so that when my husband comes home, I'm not totally absorbed in my work. We have a semblance of a normal life. We have a drink together and have dinner. Maybe after dinner, I'll read to him what I've written that day. He doesn't comment. I don't invite comments from anyone but my editor, but hearing it aloud is good. Sometimes I hear the dissonance, then I try to straighten it out in the morning. In this manner, Angelou has managed to write not only her acclaimed series of autobiographies, but numerous poems, plays, lectures, articles, and television scripts. Sometimes the intensity of her work brings on strange physical reactions. Her back goes out, her knees swell, and her eyelids, once closed, completely shut. Still, she enjoys pushing herself to the limits of her ability. I have always got to be the best, she has said. I'm absolutely compulsive, I admit it. I don't see that as a negative. So again, that's the thing about space. Another factor of writing is the creating the space for that. Think about if you put on if you how you're dressed, or if you were put on a costume, or you were in a You know, when you go to a museum and you see those the old houses where the desks and people's little writing, you know, places is like it sort of makes you feel like that person. So that could evoke a certain kind of writing, whereas if you're in a very modern place or a slick, you know, glass and steel building, that could affect your writing. Or obviously with your personal space, you have a choice as to what kind of mood you create. Maybe that influences your voices, maybe not. Another angle is I think that a lot of times writers tend to look outside themselves and to notice stuff and then try to describe it. So it's almost like copying the world in a way. I think of it sometimes as like translating, trying to translate experiences, which is a natural thing to do, but I think sometimes the danger is that that a writer can be reactive. So instead of being reactive, another idea is how you look at the world, the way it could be the way someone may, you know, a spiritual religious person gives a blessing to something, or is invoking something. You know, when you're planting a seed or putting the flowers, getting the flowers ready for the year, and you put them in the soil. There's a kind of maybe some people I try to say something. You know, I ask it to you know, take root and grow and make beautiful flowers and bring joy and let the birds come along and eat the seeds or whatever is going on there. So that becomes a participation and a blessing of something outside oneself that has an energy and a forward energy and a connectiveness to it. Because I may say, you know, may the waters come, may the sun shine and help this plant to grow. So there's a whole blessing feeling towards that, rather than the opposite direction. Is kind of say it's the flower and you're describing the flower, you know, or you're describing the soil felt like this to me, the green stem looked like this. So in that sense, you're kind of reacting to the object or the being. It's not an object, but just whatever you're writing about. So a different voice will come out if you approach it differently instead of your habitual in the sense, the tendency I think of a lot of writers to react to the world rather than to sort of take what's given. Not, you know, I think that's a natural part of the reaction, but also to give back and to have a more of a dialogue, and in that give and take within yourself, you know, come up with new ideas or new ways of experiencing the same thing, seeing, feeling, tasting all the senses, but also maybe a new angle on something. And the language, you know, the language is very powerful with that. There's a phrase I hear from native peoples a lot called anthropocentric, meaning, you know, human, always seeing things from the human perspective. Thus, the human is able to say, well, I'm personifying the desk. But again, the desk is a living entity of itself. So, but the perspective thing is too. We, you know, what is it like? I heard native friends say, like, oh, when you if you go out to the woods, you know, what maybe the trees are. You know, maybe they want to know what you why you're there. You know, they may want to know why you're there, not just that you're there to get fresh air and look at the beautiful trees and write about them. Seeing it from the other perspective, another person's perspective, another being's perspective, is also something that can certainly feed the writing. And also with the that spontaneity and the like the Bradbury, you get a word and a phrase and just go at it. One of my favorite stories where he's on the phone with his editor and he said, I got the title of my new story, and I think it's In That Attic Where the Meadow Greens, In the Attic Where the Meadow Greens or Grows, which is in and of itself a fantastical image, but that was the phrase he got. And his writer says, well, what's the story about? And Bradbury replied, "I don't know. I'll call you back in a couple hours or in an hour." And he did. He just sat down and he banged out the story, and there he had his story. So not everybody is as fortunate or able to do that, but I think if you feed that process, for me, if I'm out and about and having the notebook and even writing down just one word or a phrase, when I get home or when I have the time, either a notebook or get home at the computer, and that one word or one phrase is like, it's like pulling out the stopper of the brandy or the spice jar or whatever. It's like it just that starts the process, and then all that storehouse of images and other experiences during the day or one's life memories kind of come out in that space. But you have to give it room to breathe. You have to open that space up. So, kind of a little bit of summary. There's a sense of repetition to do these things as a discipline. There's also a sense of being open to the spontaneity. There's some of imitation and learning from others, and then there's some of finding your own voices. And there's also the creative process tends to be very celebratory, exciting, but there's also a kind of technical, clerical side, which is keeping track of your writings and going over them and editing and finding just the right words. So there's another balancing of that creative, the groovy artist and the discipline. The actual, I think the word cleric comes from a root clericos, which I think originally, if I remember correctly, it was almost like, you think of those monks doing the fancy color calligraphy and writing, or in the monasteries, or maybe at the church. It's like they were. It had a spiritual level to keeping records or keeping track of stuff. So that's something that helpful too, kind of a left brain right brain balance for a writer. And another flavor of the voices is again finding different modes or different genres that you may have. For me, obviously, there's the haiku, and then there's more topical poems and what's going on in the world, and then there's poems that just sort of spring from the heart, or they're more nature focused, or they're just about what's going on in life. So what's going on in my life or in life in general. And that again is kind of being your own manager, or kind of it's kind of being your own kind of a manager of your own personas, as a way to the different ways that your writing may come out, and to try to notice that and give you some clues as to what voices are actually writing in you or through you. Another part of the finding a voice, similar to the letting other beings speak through you, there's the haiku master Matsuo Basho had a line, "Learn from the pines about the pine and bamboo, learn from the bamboo about the boot bamboo," which sounds almost silly, but there's a truth to it that, beyond writing, I think in life as well, that there's if you want to learn about something, you need to be with it and commune with it. And the pine knows about the pine. Maybe the pine knows something about the bamboo, but the pine, the experience of being with the pine, is to teach you about the pine. And the way with any being, a wild boar, an ant, each one has a kind of energy, or what Native people call a medicine, a personality. So that spending some time to be with whatever it is, whether it's a particular being or whether it's the whole, doesn't have to be individualized. It's like sitting out, Thoreau in the Walden Pond. He was with the whole place, being with the whole place, allowing whatever voices to happen. A few weeks ago, I stepped out into the yard, and it was in the afternoon, and it just seemed like unusual, but it wasn't the typical, "Oh, I hear a specific bird." There was like a rabbit, And then I heard one bird call and another bird call in the wind, and it was this multi voices thing going on, which I realized is literally happening all the time. You know, there's always something going on, but sometimes it's more prominent. And in that moment, it was more prominent, but it taught me, like, even if the main focus is just, you know, one thing, or it's windy today, so that's the focus, there may be street noises or yard noises or different birds or whatever. So it's, again, being open to the multi voices, which in a cosmic sense is kind of speaking for the spirit. How a lot of times I see it, sometimes someone brings a message, and or someone has a message, and as a writer, one, I think if the ego gets in the way, then you become more important than trying to what the message is, what you're trying to convey. So that a lot of times it's like the spirit coming through the artist. I don't think I've met a writer who hasn't looked at something they wrote and commented, "Oh, did I really write that?" So that, you know, in that flurry of the creative process, there's a heightened energy, kind of like a bird at the bird bath, or a sexual energy going on. It's like a controlled, out of control, or pick your metaphor, that this kind of an ecstatic state that one is not in one's normal state of mind, in a way. So I don't know that every writing always has to be that exciting, but I think generally that's a good goal to have, that it is, or a good thing to pay attention to when, you know, when is it too brain? Because I think it can get too cerebral and brainy if it's not in that open creative space. When you're not allowing for other stuff to happen, it can get too intellectual. And, you know, some poetry I find is very, it can be beautifully descriptive, but it lacks feeling. You know, the table is described meticulously, and the color, and everything's worded well, but just something is missing. Maybe for me, that's typically the song of it, the music of it, the sound of it. Which is another voice, is listening to music and different kinds of music, and the rhythms, and even the rhythms and the beats of the music you listen to, that can get into the writing, the poetry. I had heard Bob Dylan talk about part of his creative process. I don't know if it still is, but obviously he's prolific. Was the process is to, he would listen to, in his head he would kind of sing or hear the notes of a classic folk song, and then he would keep playing it over and over and over in his head until it morphed into something else. So in that way, it was, you might even hear that if you were careful enough to hear it in his song, but somehow that's sort of like tapping into that river of sound and music and words, how they can all kind of feed each other. I'm trying to think of like an example of that, of a song. Like, oh, just I'm just thinking like old MacDonald Had a Farm, so just, that popped into my head. So say I'm going over and I'm like, so maybe, you know, maybe then after a while it would be like, oh, I'm looking out at the trees, you know, instead of old MacDonald Had a Farm, oh, I'm looking out at the trees. It's like finding the rhythm or the sound, almost breaking the energy down into its essence, and so to be able to tap into that sound and then use that sound for your own words, because that's it's like a rhythm, the way that you know, everybody could group of people could experience have the same experience, but people see different things or feel different things and would write different things, but that the sound, that music, that voice that's kind of in the world trying to tap into that. Into that is also a way to find another voice. How many voices can you have? Here's another. Here's a little bit of a touch of humor. Somebody I don't know of, Jonathan Edwards. Not, I don't think there was a singer-songwriter there. Sit around the shanty, put a good buzz on. I think that's Jonathan Edwards. This was a guy who lived 1703 to 1758. The 18th-century preacher and theologian, a key figure in the Great Awakening, and the author of the sermon "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." Well, that's I'm not into that sinning stuff, but anyway, it gets to the gist of why I'm mentioning this. Spent 13 hours a day in his study, beginning at 4 or 5 in the morning. He noted in his diary, "I think Christ has recommended rising early in the morning by his rising from the grave very early." To break up these long hours of private study, Edwards engaged in daily bouts of physical activity, chopping wood in the winter, walking or horse riding when the weather was good. On his walks, he carried a pen and ink to record his thoughts. For the horseback rides, he employed a mnemonic device. That mnemonic is a good word that comes from a Mnemosyne, the mother of the muses, because she knows every. She, the mother of the muses, remembers everything. So a mnemonic device. Described by the biographer George M. Marston, for each insight he wished to remember, he would pin a small piece of paper on a particular part of his clothes, which he would associate with the thought. When he returned home, he would unpin these and write down each idea. At the ends of trips of several days, his clothes might be covered by quite a few of these slips of paper. Some other examples were that Wallace Stevens, the poet, would walk. I think he was an insurance salesman. He would walk to work, and on his poem, on his walks, he would, I think, compose in his head or work on his poems. William Carlos Williams was a doctor. He had, write on the little pad, almost like prescriptions. So that's another thing in whatever one's workspace, being able to find a way to include something, and also seeing the writing, looking for, just in a way, sometimes a distraction helps, or not focusing on. Not trying to write, not focusing on the trying to write, not focusing on problem or whatever it is, sometimes helps to bring the solution, because then it just sort of happens. So I think that's another flavor of thus getting into the spontaneity of writing, is allowing the process to guide you. So it's again, it's a can be a dance of you knowing certain things you want to do and where to go with a piece. And other times the piece has a voice of its own. So I think that's a pretty good a flavor of the voices, allowing the muses to sing in you, allowing whatever being open to speak in a way, the way a mirror reflects whatever. Just allowing yourself to be open, and then see. You may have a nat. I think everybody has a kind of natural inclination to write about certain things or specific ideas or causes or whatever you want to call it, that the writing tends to gravitate to, but that's not an absolute. And to allow one to even find that, or to even to enhance the writing, or to allow. Even having that kind of focus still allows for other energies and other flavors to come in, which would improve the writing and make it, wider, better. So I think it's a matter of finding that balance of sort of what your focus is as a writer, and just whatever's going on, whatever's going on in the moment. It's different if you have a specific project, or say you're working on a book of poems about the garden, then you have more of a sense of, well, today I'm writing about thyme, today I'm writing about basil, today I'm writing about bees, today I'm writing about how thyme, basil, and bees all interact. So you can give yourself assignments more easily, I think, if you have a project in the works that helps to focus it. So that's another idea. I think that'll do it for now. And just I would say try to get to know some of the voices. Oh yeah, I meant to say that one time I was a long time ago. I've only written a few sonnets. I'm not big on the form poems, but I went into the bathroom. That I remember it because I heard a voice in my head that was different. And so I was just, I don't remember what I was doing, just going into the bathroom to get something, and I heard this quiet, I have often felt alone. And it just, the rhythm of it, I think is iambic pentameter, like very Shakespearean, but the rhythm of it had me stop and say, wait a minute, what is that? That's not quote my voice. So I did. I took that one line and I went with it. I asked a question. I was like, what's next? This quiet, I have often felt alone. I just started thinking about it and asking questions, and a sonnet came out. Okay, here it is. Yeah, I'll read it because I love this poem, and it's again, it just it was started from that this one line, and it sounded different, so I went with it. Oh yeah, here's the actual line. I'll read. The poem is called "Lusher Garden," lush, like in as in lush, lusher garden. This quiet I have often called my own, and labeled as apart from other times, and savored as a sacred time alone to filter and commune with higher rhymes. Yet now resounds the sound of neighboring bird, a note to notice what's been dubbed apart, as merely a label that's absurd, for who could claim to own what's of the heart? The steady hum a space gives off with sound is only heard by stilling of the mind. Yet hum can turn to boredom if not found someone or ones who one can call one's kind. Called forth from quietude to greet the friend, we find a lusher garden to attend. So yeah, that all started from just hearing a different voice in my head. This quiet I have often called my own. That was the line that I heard, and it was like, okay, let's just run with that. So yeah, just as much as you might try to write, again, listen for the voices, but also not just a verbal listen, an audio listen, but feel, listen. The bodily sensations, like what are they saying? Listen for those smells is so strong with the memory and transports us to places and feelings. So to listen to the what the smell is saying, so to speak. Sounds as well. Yard machines like the mowers and the blowers and all those sounds drive me a bit nuts. So that's not a pleasant sound to me. So that I could write a rant or a poem about that. I have mentioned those in poems. And so each sense, and then in the sense of the again what Bradbury mentioned, to sort of take look at it from all sides. Something that you like, something that you don't like. All the different emotions, something that you're scared of, something that you're angry about. All these things are just basically the expanding of that limited little I self that sometimes thinks that that's the one writing. And I have my little poems and I have my little perspective and here they are, and I hope you like them because I worked on them so hard. And sure, you want to be heard and you want to be liked, but I think one can care less about getting the approval if you just let what comes through. And if what comes through is good, then you try to find what, whoa, well, how did that work? How do I repeat this process? It's almost like once you find something that works for you and that creates, or wow, I really like that voice, it's somehow trying, if you can, because it's not always a exact science, to try to find the kind of formula in a sense. That's one of Ray Bradbury's essays, is how to keep and feed a muse. So that's part of his process, as mentioned, was he'd sit down and just write whatever came to mind and go with it. And then the feeding of the storehouse, but finding a process that works for you, and trying to understand that better, so at least you can have a better chance of replicating it. I had a poem once where I went into Central Park just to take a walk for 20 minutes, and I just started taking notes, and I took notes for like 2 hours, and it was one of the most, the quickest. I mean, I had to work on it, polish it up at home, but basically, it was just like the most intense pouring out or into me of the images and feelings into a poem that I think I've ever experienced, and that's, that can happen with a shorter poem. That was a rare experience. Sometimes it really take a lot of work. So that's another flavor of voices, is looking over your work as a kind of editor, in a sense. I read a poem, and then when the poem comes out, then I read it over with an editor's eye. I read it over with a proofreading eye. I read it out loud to hear how it sounds. Some word that maybe just not the exact word. So those are all kind of other subtle flavors of, not so much the muse or creative voice, although it could be, but more of the technical aspects of the writing, that is another flavor of voices. So, all right, that's plenty of voices for you to ponder and to work with, and listen deep for what rings true. Thank you so much for listening to this, and may it guide you and help you with your writings and your life experiences, and share some of the ideas with others if you like, and feel free to follow up and ask some questions or share something cool that happened from this process. And many blessings.